back and forth.
That's true. Family is flexible.
Uh-huh. Thank you, Jamie. All right, I'm going to call to order the work session for the Metro Council, July 16th, 2019. All accounted in for today. We have a full house, don't we? Yeah. Hello, anybody there?
Yes.
I will ask Councillor Lewis to read the safety briefing. Thank you.
Please.
With vim and vigor. With vim and vigor.
With vim and vigor, we are all noting that we're on the third floor of this building, and in the event of a fire or fire alarm, please exit out through the door in the northeast corner of this room, go down the steps to the second floor, and exit through the main entrance by the reception desk. We will meet in the courtyard outside that entrance. Lucky it's sunny. In the event of a medical or fire emergency, please call 911 and notify the security agent at the front desk of the emergency. The nearest defibrillator is mounted at the steps leading from the reception desk down to Grand Avenue, so like right below us. And a fire extinguisher is located in the corridor alongside the dais behind that wall.
Awesome job.
Nice job.
Thank you. All right, we've got two work sessions talked about today. The first one being the clean air construction standards, and we have Tracy Fisher and Jenna Garman to make that presentation. Come on up. Welcome.
Hello, good afternoon.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Council President Peterson and councilors. My name is Jenna Garman. I coordinate Metro's internal sustainability program. I'm here with Tracy Fisher. She's a senior procurement analyst, and we are happy to be with you today to brief you on work done to date to develop a regional clean air construction standard to reduce diesel pollution and to also get your guidance on how we might adopt that standard for Metro projects. So first, we'll share some background information on why we need to do more to address diesel pollution and how we're proposing to address it through our public contracts. And then at the end of that presentation, we will seek your guidance on the policy issues that will momentarily show up on the screen. So the work on the clean air construction standard has been and will continue to be a regional effort with the agencies listed on this slide. And we have at least...
Is your microphone on, or could you speak closer? Pull it towards you.
Just pull it towards you, I guess.
It's probably on. It just needs to be closer.
Just getting closer.
Is that better?
Oh, yeah. No, pull the whole thing closer. There you go.
Sorry. It's invasive, yeah.
We do have at least one of our agency partners here today. We have
Kathy. Do the trick.
Still not.
There we
go. Oh, my gosh. Okay, I'm going to have to swallow it, I guess. Kathleen Johnson with Washington County is with us.
Thank you.
Both the City of Portland and Multnomah County have already adopted the Clean Air Construction Standard, and Washington County is in progress. So why focus on diesel exhaust? I'm sure you're all well aware that diesel pollution is deadly. It causes up to 460 premature deaths in Oregon every year. Diesel exhaust poses one of the highest health risks of any toxic air contaminant in our regional airshed. Exposure to diesel exhaust can increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, heart attack, stroke, lead to low weight and preterm births, can cause cancer and premature death, and it can exacerbate asthma. There's also a growing body of evidence that links traffic-related air pollution, including diesel pollution, to neurodevelopmental disorders like autism spectrum disorder. And children, older people, and people with compromised immune systems are especially vulnerable to the health impacts of diesel pollution. Research also shows that black carbon in diesel exhaust is the second largest contributor to global warming. And we have a significant diesel problem in our region. This map shows pollution levels relative to Oregon health benchmarks. And really the key takeaway here, is that there are no areas in the metro region that have safe levels of diesel pollution. In some areas, like near freight corridors and rail yards and construction sites, shown in the darkest red on this map, diesel pollution levels are over 10 times higher than our state health benchmarks. And we also know that diesel pollution is an environmental justice issue. Pollution levels tend to be at highest in neighborhoods with more residents who are low income and people of color. We also know that most of... Yes?
Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yes.
The map shows a huge area of intense pollution in Washington County. Is that because of weather patterns and the basin effect as well as the point sources that accumulate there? Or do we know?
Councillor Stacey, that's a great question. I'm not 100%.
I mean, obviously 205 and I-5 are major mm-hmm. producers in 26, but that vast area, which includes some almost rural land to the southwest, suggests that maybe the Tualatin Basin is holding pollutants low.
That is a good guess. I am not sure.
Not a reason not to regulate. I'm just wondering why that.
Our information tells us that the diesel problem in the metro region is a combination of our industrial activity and weather patterns, geological formations, and then also the lack of standards that we have in Oregon. So it's difficult for us to know exactly why that particular region is so heavily affected, but those are the general contributions.
Yeah. Thank you.
So we also know the diesel exhaust in our region primarily comes from non-road equipment, like construction equipment. And while federal regulations require that newer engines have pollution emission controls in place, those older, dirty diesel engines are still really prevalent due to their long lifespan. And it's not uncommon to see 30-year-old equipment on construction sites. The good news is that solutions are readily available. Emissions control technology on new engines and retrofits for old engines can cut emissions by as much as 95%. So the Clean Air Construction Collaborative took all of these factors into account and also best practices from research done on similar programs from across the country in developing the standard. Our goals for the standard are to first and foremost reduce diesel emissions on our public construction projects. Secondly, we're committed to supporting a diverse contractor pool, and we want to ensure that our efforts to advance equity in contracting continue. Third, we want to reduce cost and administrative impacts on contractors and on project managers. And lastly, we want to foster regional adoption to expand the reach of the standard. And the Clean Air Construction Standard attempts to strike a balance between all of these goals. There has been a long history of stakeholder engagement on this issue that has helped to shape the standard. That history is described in more detail in the background document in your packet. Most recently, the City of Portland and Multnomah County held a workshop and then solicited public comments on the standard in November of last year, and 98% of the comments received were in support of the standard. Feedback from all of this engagement has been incorporated into the standard. There's also just been significant public pressure on public agencies to do more to address air pollution and improve local air quality. If Council provides direction to continue work toward adoption of the standard for metro projects, we will create an engagement plan with a particular focus on COBID firms and diesel-impacted communities. With that background, I'll turn it over to Tracy to tell you more about the details of the standard.
Okay, are you ready for some details? All right. The standard will apply to new metro construction contracts. It will apply to engine requirements for non-road equipment, 25 horsepower and greater. These are generally rideable equipment, and on-road cement mixers and dump trucks. There's a phase-in schedule, which allows contractors to plan for the implementation based on what they have in their equipment inventory. There are multiple compliance options, since there's not a one-size-fits-all solution. There are exemptions for safety and other predefined circumstances, and COVID firms have an extended compliance timeline. And just to make sure we're all understanding the term, COVID, of course, is the collection of certified firms, minority women, emerging small business, and service-disabled veteran. So here is a summary of what the phase-in schedule will look like. We start with idle reduction requirements January 1st, 2020, and then you'll notice the tier schedule. EPA classifies emission pollution controls by tier. The higher the tier, the more the controls, the lower the pollution, cleaner equipment. So in 2021, we'll begin phasing out older, dirtier equipment tiers. On-road vehicle requirements begin in 2024, and then by 2026, only newer engines and some previously retrofitted engines will be allowed. No new retrofits will be allowed.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So I'm generally supportive of a phased-in approach. In terms of these steps and the effective dates, are these just ours, or are these shared across the local governments in the collaborative?
The idea is for the regional collaborative to have a single schedule, and our goal, staff's goal, considering your approval, would be for Metro to join at the beginning of the standard. If we decide to join at any time later in the standard, we would jump in where the standard is at that point in time.
Okay.
So that's part of the benefit of taking a regional approach. It's intended to create less confusion for the companies who have to comply, so that they know that everybody's on the same timeline. This is the standard. It also helps reduce costs and make the compliance process more efficient for both contractors and agencies. The City of Portland has volunteered to be the lead agency to administer the program, and core elements will include registration and verification of equipment, creation of a regional compliance database, issuance of decals, and support for contractors. In recognition that COVID firms already face barriers in getting access to the contracting process, the proposed regional framework also includes things like extended compliance options, additional program support to assist COVID firms with compliance. And then the collaborative is also working to secure funding for to help COVID firms retrofit or replace construction equipment and vehicles, including Volkswagen settlement funds and EPA grant funding. Metro could also consider implementing additional technical and financial support upon council direction. The program will have financial implications both at the project and program level. Based on research done by about other programs that have been implemented around the country, we can expect that retrofit costs on a $1 million project would range between $600 and $5,700, which will likely get passed on to Metro.
Between $600 and $5,700.
Yeah, $0.00
expenditure.
Yeah, so it's 0.06% to 0.57%. So less than 1% cost is
perhaps
the estimate.
We're not doing enough.
And one thing to note too is that there's a one-time upfront upgrade fee, and once that equipment is upgraded, it then gets used on other projects and doesn't need to be upgraded. So when we think about these costs, they're on one project and then would work for the rest of the projects that equipment is placed on. So Metro will also need to contribute to the regional collaborative, and the collaborative is still working out what the cost-sharing details will be, but at this time, we expect that Metro's contribution would likely be between 4 and 10% of the regional costs. It would be based in part on how many projects would fall under the standard. And as Councillor Stacey is pointing out, we calculate that these costs are pretty low, especially considering that we estimate a 10-to-1 return on human health impacts.
One more, again, on the clarification,
mm-hmm.
0.06% to 0.57% for the entity that is doing the construction?
That would be
Then our contribution separately.
So that would be the project cost. So for the construction firm to upgrade their equipment,
The
estimate is under 1%.
Okay.
In addition to that, we also need to contribute to the regional collaborative program.
Just making sure.
Okay.
And we're only talking about COVID firms, correct?
No, that would be for any firm. So that's, yeah. And, of course, consider that that this standard, if applied to a project, applies to all contractors on the project, from the prime contractor down through subcontractors.
I'm trying to understand how much Metro's picking up. That's what this is? Is that what you're saying?
So we're expecting that the additional cost for a project would be under 1%. So if you have a $1 million project and firms have to comply, their additional costs would be about $600 to $5,700. And then, of course, they would pass those costs on to Metro.
So that's the additional project cost.
For a $1 million project.
And the regional administration shared cost.
Yeah. So we have those two things combined. And those and regional administration costs are annual costs. The estimates.
And 4 to 10% of annual costs, which costs? The costs of all contracts or of all?
The cost of administering the collaborative, the regional program.
Great.
So the City of Portland will be the lead agency. They will be administering the program, and they expect for partner agencies to contribute to those costs. We know that the Oregon legislature just passed a diesel bill, House Bill 2007, and that bill is aimed at phasing out older diesel truck engines, particularly in the Tri-County area that we serve. I have a summary of the bill's key provisions up here. And notice that there is some overlap, but this bill does not sufficiently address the air quality issues in the metro region, and specifically, it doesn't address any of Metro's construction off-road needs. It may address some on-road usage in general in the region, but it's not a complete overlap with what we're trying to do. Also, DEQ is a part of the collaborative. They will be setting up the rules and process for House Bill 2007, and we will be working with them to make sure that this clean air construction standard is we're coordinating as much as possible and hopefully sharing some of the infrastructure and procedural elements with the implementation of House Bill 2007. As I mentioned before, this is going to be a regional standard, and implementation steps and timelines are fixed among all partner agencies, but each agency does get to determine the threshold of projects that the standard will apply to. So Metro can set the threshold wherever we choose, just to match the number and types of projects that we would like to capture. To give some reference, Multnomah County set their threshold at $500,000, and the City of Portland set their threshold at $1 million. That is reflecting the type of projects that they do. So in our discussions with staff, we zeroed in on a couple options of thresholds to consider, and we've presented you here with two of those. One is $500,000, and we've also presented a lower $100,000 for public improvement, $150,000 for other construction services, and that just aligns with the formal procurement threshold at Metro. Both of these have pros and cons. A higher threshold means that we would capture fewer projects, but we would provide consistency with Multnomah County, and we expect a smaller impact on COVID-certified firms. A lower threshold, on the other hand, will likely provide greater air quality improvements, and it will align with existing procurement procedures that may be more impactful for COVID firms, and it may require more Metro resources to be able to administer that program internally and as well as contributions to the regional collaborative. We could also consider other thresholds. Councillor Stacey.
Thank you. If, in fact, we were to issue a grant for $100,000 to a small firm, perhaps a COVID firm, that needs to buy new equipment because the stuff they were otherwise going to use can't be retrofitted, and there's a significant cost, they would propose to add that cost to the overall bid. And could we do that, just as we do with the larger ones? We're picking up the marginal cost of bringing their equipment into conformance. Would we do that at this lower threshold as well? Therefore, it becomes a Metro cost rather than a cost on the COVID firm? Or am I misunderstanding something?
Absolutely. If Metro decided to allocate more resources to help firms with retrofitting or upgrading their equipment, that would be a decision that you as counselors would need to make. And if we decided to do that, yes, absolutely. We could apply that at any level that we like, as long as we back that up with the proper resources from Metro.
And do we have an estimate of that higher level of broader scope of a program in terms of, you say, 29 projects per year with an average value of $600,000? So we'd have more costs that we would incur as a result of having that lower threshold, but we reap air quality benefits that are commensurate with that investment.
There is, we would definitely reap additional air quality benefits. Because off-road equipment, non-road equipment, does not require any sort of registration, it has been very difficult for us to compile a list of exactly what equipment is out there and what state it's in. And so it's been difficult for us to come up with clear estimates on the impact per dollar spent. There is some work going on in the collaborative to try to settle on a better number for that, but we do not yet have that information.
And last thinky question, would we be barred or would it be disruptive of the collaborative if we were to have a higher bar for our own grants, a lower threshold,
Are we talking about grants?
For our own contracts.
No.
We're not talking about
cost
grants.
Of the project.
Bob's misusing the English language while asking this question.
Yeah, so I believe your question is if it would be disruptive to the program if Metro were to decide that our threshold for applying the standard were lower than other regional partners. No. It would simply mean that there may be contractors who want to work with us that would need to comply with the program that would not necessarily need to comply with the program when working with other regional partners.
And they would expect us to pay a premium to get them to fix their equipment, essentially.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Generally, that's the way it works when we put requirements like this on. The contractors pass the costs on to us.
Councillor Dirksen and Councillor Chase.
Well, I think either way, the cost would come back to us because replacing or upgrading the equipment would become part of the bid. So it would cost us more anyway. But it would be limited to only those who actually receive the get the contract. Question is, do we have any kind of analysis of what kind of impact this would have on total diesel particulate? Obviously, construction is a small percentage of total diesel usage because, you know, trucks driving around all the time. So I'm just curious if there's been any way to measure what we would anticipate would be the result of doing this.
Councillor Dirksen, not to my knowledge. I think because of our limited awareness of how many pieces, since we don't have a registration process in place for non-road equipment, we're not quite sure what equipment is out there.
But you do have an estimate, pardon me, in this ring diagram back on the sixth page that suggests that the vast majority, two-thirds, of diesel emissions are from off non-road sources.
Oh, good point. Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that.
So, for me, that's...
Other couple more questions?
Sorry.
Typically, when we phase in something like this, it's in order to help buffer the financial impact on who has to meet this requirement. But looking at the figures, it sounds as though the cost compared to a cost of a project is relatively low. Councillor Stacey says, are we really doing enough? My question would be, what would be the benefit or the reason why we would phase this in other than just require it? Is it more cost, or does it have to do with just a timeline and physically how long it would take companies to turn their inventory over or do the retrofit? They just need time to do it. Is that more it? Okay, so there's a concrete reason why. Otherwise, I'm going like, well, if it's only going to cost that much, let's just do it. Why do we need to stretch out the change? But if there is an actual concrete reason, then I understand why. Otherwise, I'd be willing to go, let's just start doing this now. I mean, less than 1%, I think we can handle that.
Councillor Durston, that's an excellent question. Based on the feedback that we did get, the construction standard attempts to strike a balance between the stakeholders who would like us to just do exactly what you're saying, is implement the standards immediately, and contractors who have said, please give us some time to upgrade our equipment.
Okay. The other thing is that in light of relative costs, I mean, look at the different thresholds. I think it would be best for us to be, as part of this collaborative, to come up with a standard for all of us. That's going to make it simpler for everybody if the same standard applies across the board. But I think I would want to push for the lower threshold. Again, I don't see a reason why, unless you could tell me some, why you would want to exempt certain projects just because they're this much smaller.
Indeed, in our conversations with staff, we have anecdotal information that many of our smaller projects may include a lot of dirty equipment. So if we would like to be more comprehensive about how we address this issue, a lower threshold would be appropriate.
Right. Well, but I guess my question is, why would you want to consider any? Is there a reason to consider some other threshold other than the lower one? I mean, there's a positive to doing the lower one. What's the balance? What's the positive of the higher threshold?
Mainly, it's the administrative, reduced burden on administrative requirements to comply, both internally as a collaborative and also for our contracting partners. So we're just trying to balance those things.
One of those considerations is the, in particular, the impact on COBID certified firms, and that the lower, if we go with a lower standard, it's likely to capture more of those
more
firms.
Of those.
And again, that leaves me puzzled. COBID firm has limited resources. If anybody has to roll up the cost as part of their bid for replacing or retrofitting that equipment, it would likely be a small firm. We are saying that we are going to cover that as part of the bid review process, I presume, and would acknowledge that that added cost from that COBID firm should be fully recognized and included in the contract price.
Mr. Scott.
I'm speaking more generally about procurement. I think the challenge is going to be, it gets back to the timing issue. So you're going to have large firms that either are already in compliance or will see this coming and will upgrade their equipment. Some of the larger, smaller firms may not do that, in which case when they're bidding, if they roll those costs in, it won't be competitive. So I think that gets to the issue in terms of the threshold. So we can agree to pay those costs, but as a bid comes in for a $100,000 project, we may see that some of those smaller firms that say, hey, I've got to replace this equipment, and thus their contract bid at that point is more expensive than another firm, because it is a one-time cost. Once you've upgraded your equipment, you've upgraded your equipment.
We're trying to help COBID firms. We're trying to get cleaner air.
Yep,
so why wouldn't we go ahead and have that
expense? Yeah, I think we've acknowledged that we have an issue we're going to try to work to resolve here.
Just trying to understand.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's okay. I'm just trying to summarize it so that we can get to the next thing. Councillor Chase, and then...
I'm going to hold. It's in this arena, but I think I can save it.
So I guess what I'm hearing, to try and find a way to summarize this, is that if I get head nods, the council would like to think about the lower standards. But if there's a way in the procurement process not to hold that against the COBID firms, so we separate that cost out and we set it aside, I'm not sure if that's legally possible, but I think that's what I'm hearing the question is how do you allow for that competitive issue not to be a part of the problem, or it's acknowledged and we find a way to work with it. Because otherwise, if we don't lower, we will miss out on a lot of the projects, because a lot of the projects we're trying to make smaller so that they can bid on them. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to be very careful and just ask for you guys to kind of go back and come back with some sort of resolution to that. So, Councillor Lewis, and then Councillor Chase.
I would just say you very elegantly summed up both what had been stated, but also some of the thoughts in my head. I will add one other thing to add to what seems to be some support for the lower threshold. I'm 100% there for the lower threshold if we make sure that we have a contingency plan for putting bids out that we don't get responses because we've created yet another barrier. Mm-hmm. I know we've had some bids go out for the lower 100,000s where nobody bites. So if we go out the first time and nobody bites, I want us to have contingency plans.
Good point.
Thank you.
You know, I guess I would chime in and say that, so as I'm understanding it, we would offer, we might have a project and we might either have folks bid on how much it would cost to build that project and they would factor in these costs, or we might say, you know, we have $1 million to do X, we want you to tell us how much work you can do for $1 million, right? I mean, those are the two procurement options. And I guess I'm not sure if that's correct or not. But what I would say is I thought I read that we had exemptions for COBID in the early years.
At least extended compliance, yeah.
Is it so I guess I would just chime in. I like the it's funny how we're saying we like a lower standard.
Lower threshold.
Higher standard.
Yes. I like a lower standard. I like a quicker timeline. I do really want to have sensitivity around the COVID and actually even more specifically the women and minority owned contractors. So to me, if we can narrow it down even to that subgroup of COBID, you know, I'm getting into legal areas that I'm sure we run into problems, but that would be ideal to me. Or if we can enhance and support, rather than exempting COBID, enhancing and providing bonus dollars to those entities or helping them, and that could go either towards the cost of renting the proper equipment or retrofitting. But, you know, to me, this is an issue where we want to be as aggressive as we can because time's not on our side. It's too late. So, you know, to me, it's the lowest possible level we can get to and the quickest timeline. And then finding ways to compensate and support the contractors and the COBID folks that still have challenges in the system.
Before we move on, any...
No,
there were actually two parts to that. One was just a reiteration of what we just discussed, right? But also the timeline. And so could you just, before we move on to other comments, could you just talk a little bit about how, I mean, I understand how you, the process by which you came up with 2026 as full implementation, but what were the issues, what specifically held us back from a quicker timeline? And I'm just talking like a year or 2 years. I mean, this is quite a long run-up, especially for 2020 to just be no idling. It's like an almost a no movement, but because being able to do compliance in the field on idling is virtually like you can't do it. So how did we get here, and was there a discussion about a quicker ramp up, and what held everybody back?
President Peterson, that's a great question. Tracy and I were not involved in the collaborative at the time that these timelines were discussed. We do have some partners here. Again, my understanding is that we were trying to balance concerns expressed by contractors around allowing them enough time to plan for and anticipate and pay for upgrades to their equipment with the concerns we're hearing from you that we need these standards in place as quickly as possible. So that's my general sense of how we came up with those timelines. And seeing some head nods from our partners.
Would you like to come forward?
Yeah.
And just sit with staff? I think it's a really important topic that we need to understand.
And that's why we invited our
thank you.
Yeah.
Much appreciated. Introduce yourself.
Councillor Peterson, Metro Councillors, thank you. My name is Kyle Diesner with the City of Portland, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. In our very first proposal for this that we went out to do stakeholder engagement with, we did propose to put this in place in 1 year. Mm. The pushback from the contracting community was nearly insurmountable as they started to put together the costs, estimates of what it would do to their businesses, mm-hmm. and then that cost impact on our agencies, particularly from the City of Portland's perspective as the largest, construction developer in, among all of our agency jurisdictions, the cost impacts were pretty substantial. And so we negotiated back a phased-in approach. Now, this was really bolstered by research findings from other jurisdictions who have done this work that found that a phased-in approach was really, really critical for getting a high level of compliance. Contractors make these investments very seriously over a long time horizon. They plan well in advance for them, and we need to give them the time to do that. Putting everything into effect in 1 year could have significant financial implications for those contractors. So I'll see what John wants to add.
Hi, my name is John Boczynski. I'm the Director of Sustainability for Multnomah County, and I think Kyle put it really well. I would just add one other factor is not all – so we're doing this as a collaborative to do – employing a collective impact model. While the Metro Council is maybe very aggressive in the standards and the thresholds and the timelines, other local jurisdictions may prioritize the same issues differently. So it's both a reflection of what we heard across the board. Certainly from the environmental advocacy community, they would like us to go faster, but we felt it important to accommodate, at least in some way, what we were hearing from contractors, what we were hearing from bureau directors, and then also what we were hearing from other partner jurisdictions. Just to remind folks around the table that we're also working with the Port of Portland, TriMet, and Washington County to implement these standards. And so we're trying to kind of find a standard so we can employ this collective impact model and have it be something that's palatable across all these different jurisdictions
that
where
helps.
The politics
Thank
are
you.
Slightly different. And something this board may be familiar with.
Yeah. Thank you. Much appreciated. Councillor Chase, and then...
Since we have our esteemed guests,
yes.
I'll take advantage of this question. Are there any other alternative options on supporting COVID firms than just kind of a blanket exemption for all COVID? Is there an option to really focus on women and minority-owned business? Is there an option to support extra resources rather than exemptions?
Councillor Chase, I'll just start and then probably Metro Stat. I would just say that the one big thing is that there is this $57 million from the VW Settlement Fund where the legislature has prioritized areas of the state that have the highest impact, aka the metro area, COVID contractors, which we're talking about here today. So that's a pretty substantial amount of funding. The collaborative recently worked with Portland Business Development Group to support their application for Diesel Emissions Reduction Act funding from the EPA so that they could specifically work with their constituencies, which are minority and women-owned businesses, to get cleaner equipment into their fleets in anticipation of these standards. The one exception, everybody gets to the cleanest standard. The one exception within the standard is that if a COVID firm invests in a diesel oxidation catalyst, which may be an appropriate piece of technology because the type of filtration device that you put onto a piece of equipment depends on how you use it, how old the equipment is, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of sort of technical aspects to it. And what we're saying is for the COVID firms, if you have taken that step to apply that technology, we're not going to then a few years later penalize you and make you go back and either get rid of that piece of equipment or put on a more advanced piece of technology. What we're saying for COVID firms alone is that you can continue to use that equipment until you've depreciated it or until you've decided to take that out of your fleet. And then when you come in with a new piece of equipment, you got to have this cleaner stuff. And that would be managed through our registration program that we talked about.
So the COVID doesn't come into play until 2026. There's a lot of money on the table. I think what I'm hearing is a lot of negotiation to get here and a lot of trend analysis, I'm assuming, will be done over the next several years to find out how things are progressing and whether anybody's getting kicked out. Because I just know that COVIDs are not going to make the investment unless it's a for sure thing, because they're not going to go and be able to get the money to do it, or B, put it in and not have a project to back them up because they're out of business then. So I'm sure we will be I feel comfortable hearing your explanation. Does everybody with this timeline? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. There was just some feedback that I wanted to give based on kind of two pieces of my brain that react to this. One is absolutely I want the lower threshold and the higher standards, especially given Councilor Lewis's contingency plan, because the contingency plan almost directly relates to what the other part of my economic strain is telling me, is that at that low threshold, you know, do we have the critical mass for contracts of this scale to take advantage of that option, which is why a contingency would be really important. But most importantly, what I'm struggling to kind of identify is what path do I want to take is, a lot of our work with C2P2 has been aligning the same kind of regional metrics and goals across all jurisdictions. And so the reason that I bring that up is because for a contract as low as $100,000, for the critical mass and for the market to really pick that up, I question whether, you know, the value is there, although the inherent value of what we want to achieve is there. And, of course, the cost that it would basically the marginal benefit in my mind. I'm trying to figure that out, and I don't know if I have enough data. Also understanding with the C2P2 work that we're doing of wanting to streamline to make it easier for all contractors across all our jurisdictions to actually implement it instead of finding ways to bypass it. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Councilor Gonzalez, you bring up a really good point. As we are thinking about a lot of initiatives that we are trying to implement here at Metro and across the region, we are looking at creating additional contracting requirements for our business partners. And C2P2 is another thing that will take significant administrative resources on for our contractors and for Metro to be able to comply with those standards. Plus, this is another requirement that's being added to our construction contracts. And so we're targeting a group of contracts with a couple different initiatives all at the same time. And so there are administrative needs in order to be able to support that. So I would also add that COVID support in particular could include more logistical support, more administrative support to be able to comply with these standards really well. And we did have a really good brainstorming session actually quite a while ago here at Metro with Metro staff and DEQ staff talking about different ways that we could support COVID firms in addition to just giving them money. So I think that it sounds like maybe some of you would be open to exploring some of those options as well and seeing if there's something that we can implement that's a little bit more creative.
All right. What I'd like to do is thank our guests for coming up and clarifying that for us. I'll excuse you. And then can we move on to the potential next steps and come to a summary conclusion here?
Absolutely. Thank you very much. So when council directs us to continue with this work, these are the next steps. Of course, we will continue working with our regional partners to develop a common framework. We will continue to engage our stakeholders. COBID certified firms are the particular target in that area. We will also be pursuing different support options for the COBID firms. And then later this year, we will need to bring the standard to you for adoption. So with that, we do recognize that in many ways we have got preliminary direction to adopt the Clean Air Construction Standard through letters of support and other initiatives. So we're seeking explicit direction from you today to continue with the standard. And And we have got great guidance on your approach to how comprehensive this program needs to be and what sort of threshold we should be approaching, so thank you for that. And we also would be happy to have any individual discussions with you to follow up with more detail on things or bring another presentation to the workshop session.
Councillor Craddock, Councillor Dirksen.
So I have some questions that are more general and just curiosity questions, not specific maybe to some of the next steps here. So you answer one of my questions is what's the budget here? And so it sounds like you're going to come back to us with, I guess it was the previous slide that you were showing us, regarding the financial side of this. How much is this going to cost to support, particularly to support these co-bid firms? Is that correct? That's one of your next steps? So that will answer that question. So the other question I have is, who's monitoring all this? How do we know this is going to really happen? I'm thinking, of course, more about when I'm looking at House Bill 2007 and what the state's requiring, I don't see anything in there about idling. And I live in the east part of the region. If you go to Troutdale and to the truck stop there, there will be 20 trucks sitting there all idling. And if they're sleeping, or I don't know why they keep their motors running all the time, especially in the wintertime. Where are we with that? And I mean, I recognize that's not Metro's responsibility, but what have discussions have occurred around that kind of activity?
Page 10.
So for on-road vehicles, the state is the only entity that can regulate idling. There is specific law that prohibits local governments from governing idling on
the Truckers Association.
So that's something that this may be a to-do for the future. Is that correct? Is that something that's...
That would be something that we would have to discuss with Oregon legislature.
Right. I mean, that like might be a goal that we might have for the legislature.
Let's run up that hill again. That's good.
So the other question then, and of course, the registration plans, I assume then, how does that work?
Councillor Craddock, we are meeting every other week with the regional partners to develop the framework for administering the standard at the regional level. We're envisioning that contractors will submit their information to register their vehicles and equipment to the City of Portland. City of Portland will verify the data and issue decals. Once the data's been verified, that information will be entered into a regional database that all of the partners can access.
Okay, thank you. Obviously, this when you start having these discussions, you recognize that, and this is really creative, and you've done a great job with this. But then on the other side, you realize, wow, we had a long ways to go to really have an impact. Again, I'm thinking about generators and people's residential, people that live in single-family households that have generators, the people that camp, that take generators with them in those giant RVs. That none of that, of course, is being addressed here. I recognize that. But I also don't see it being addressed at the state level either. So what you've done is you've alerted me to some of the things that we need to be thinking about for the future and, of course, for future legislation.
I think that's an excellent point, and I think that it's important for our agencies to get our own houses in order and to walk our talk, and that gives us more leverage to then push for additional work across the region.
Councillor Dirksen, did you have a final comment?
Well, yes, thank you. I appreciate the conversation today and looking at the different options. I'm supportive of the council's desire to, if possible, shorten the timeline, also supportive of the lower threshold. But I'll be interested to hear what the response is to that from the rest of the collaborative and also from the industry. I know that from being involved in large construction projects that equipment, I had the word, I should have written it down. The cost of equipment over time is a big part of your business model. Depreciation, that's the word I'm looking for. And so just as TriMet would like to switch to electric buses, but they're not going to get rid of almost brand new buses to do that. It's challenging how quickly you can turn over, financially turn over your inventory. The other concern about the lower threshold would be is that I can envision times when smaller projects need almost as much equipment as a big project, just not for as long. So the cost, the percentage of cost, total cost for the project could be at some times be detrimental. So I'd be interested to hear from those that calculate that kind of thing, what that means to the ability to do this. Assuming that it's okay, I mean that it works out, I'm very supportive of the lower threshold, but we don't want to overly impact the cost of our projects or drive firms away from even being able to bid on them as a result.
Councillor Chase has the last word, and then I'll summarize.
Okay. This is a side comment that I've always kind of wanted to get out there, which is I always wonder if, and you don't have to answer it, but it's just more of a comment to say I hope we're looking at places like Interstate Rental, kind of, you know, places that rent out a lot of equipment, because I'm thinking a lot of smaller firms end up using those, and sure, they probably get a very heavy use, and I know they still have a lot of the old school diesel stuff. My other real question is, we're of course applying this to our own projects that we are procuring, and I'm wondering if other jurisdictions have gone a step further to say those that we fund also, and just to get a kind of perspective about where others are on that issue.
Councillor Chase, to your first question about rental equipment, the City of Portland did issue a request for information for rental companies to describe what kind of equipment they have. They only got one response to that RFI, but the rental company's equipment was very new and it all complied with the standard. And so that did give us somewhat of an indication that rental company equipment tends to be cleaner.
That's why that one responded.
Exactly.
I am a regular at one of them, and it's not the one that responded.
Well, that is our great hope anyway.
And may I just add to that? As we've talked a lot about our COVID firms that we work with, it may also be in our interest to look at some of the smaller rental companies, and maybe they need some support as well. So when we're thinking about more creatively as a comprehensive approach to getting this this program implemented, actually making change in the standard, we can think broader and maybe come up with some additional solutions. So just one of the brainstorming things that we had come up with in that session, completely unvetted, but different things that we can think about if we want to be more comprehensive.
Can I address that very briefly? If the standard applies to on your project, it's the equipment you use, not just the equipment you own. So if you rent it, it still needs to meet the standard.
That's correct. Yeah. Just to your second point, I do know the City of Portland, the City Council does have, I believe, scheduled already in the fall to have a conversation about whether or not to apply the standard to their investment. So I do know that other agencies are contemplating that as something that we could contemplate as well as part of the regional investment strategy.
Yeah, I think that's where we'll need to go. As I try to summarize this up, you seem to have enough head nods to move forward with the Clean Air Construction Standard for Metro. I don't think that I saw enough interest in changing and upsetting what did you call it? The collaborative complex, blah, 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 blah. No, I had never heard of it. We do it, but I've never heard the term. We don't want to upset that conversation that's happening at a regional level, but knowing that the council, if there was a way to accelerate this, would have your back having that conversation, but not to upset moving forward on it and getting everybody on board. But however, we are interested in our own lower threshold, higher standard, and whether that would get us a benefit in moving forward. So, and then obviously keeping going on these COVID questions and slowly working to deal with them as they come up. The only other thing I would add is as we enter into the summer season, we probably should remind employees that idling beyond a certain time period that's approved is not allowed unless there's a health danger, safety issue. I had a problem.
That's a great point.
Can I ask one more question?
I'm
just curious, so how is the state DEQ monitoring all of this, and how often do they monitor? They're measuring diesel particulates, and how often? So it would be nice to see over time what happens with the diesel particulates. It would be nice that you could bring us data graph or whatever that would show us if this has any impacts, and that might influence our decision to do more.
Thank you, Councillor Craddock. Our partners at DEQ are currently undergoing a study to get a better estimate for the quality of our air here in the region. They have been in the past relying on EPA general figures and will be applying much more detailed individual regional indicators to their measurements to come up with more detailed and precise measurements. That is forthcoming, so as soon as we get that information, we would be happy to share it.
And, of course, we've added that discussion into the transportation package with the task force. So, all right. All right. Good work. Obviously, a lot of interest. So thank you for getting us this far, and thanks to the region for leading the way on our partners on leading the way on this. And
thank you, councillors.
Thank you.
Starting those discussions. All right. Moving on to the next agenda item. We've got, the one thing I forgot to add to the summary was the next steps conversation about the regional investment strategies impact of all of these. So we can talk about that later. Next, we have 3.2, regional solid waste system infrastructure update. We've got Roy Brower and several other people. I have Roy, so you'll need to.
I will introduce.
Thank you.
Give us 30 seconds here.
30 seconds. Okay.
Water break. She just ran to grab some water real quick.
Thanks for standing by.
Happy to do it.
And I'll review our understanding of the rate setting criteria.
Nothing new there.
It's all very logical.
I wasn't sure if you had anything. So I guess we can just get going.
Okay.
Wasn't sure.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Good afternoon.
We're here today to talk about the future of the regional waste system. This is part three of a three-part series. Today, here really to talk about financing the future of the system. I'm Roy Brower, your interim PES director. I have with me today Brian Kennedy, your interim FRS director, and Cinnamon Williams, who's actually in a real job.
All of us are interim. You know, every 4 years, we have to go back and see if we're still on board.
Only the furniture is permanent. And Cinnamon is the Parks and the PES finance manager, and she's also responsible for rate setting. And so we're here today to really talk to you about, as you recall, back June 11th, seems so long ago, we talked about the current system, current solid waste system. I, at that time, I expressed to you how outdated the system was, how there's been a real lack of investment over the last 20 years. The system is really over capacity. We have long lines of people waiting to drop off their waste or get items recycled, and how that's all contributing to much less recovery. On June 18th, we had an executive session where we talked about specific projects and properties, and I won't go through that for this particular session, but I did want to just remind you, big picture, the 10-year investment that we discussed with you is in the neighborhood of $400 million plus. If you look at potential private investments of $13 million, I&I grants of at least $30 million over the next 2 years, of course, if it's extended, there would be more potentially available. Community enhancement program fees of around $13 million over 10 years. And then some of the capital projects that we discussed with you at the executive session, that's between $275 and $350 million. So just put that out there just so we and you have a scale to measure by. Just a quick reminder, much of what we're planning and what we have proposed is embedded in the regional waste plan that was adopted by this council in March. We're looking to that for the next 12 years and relying on that as not just about garbage, but it's about jobs, it's about the economy, it's about equitable access, health, the environment, reduction of GHGs, better resilience in public services. So we're now poised to look at the solid waste system in a much broader perspective and a much broader view. Last month I suggested that we're at a similar time as when we were moving to a regional landfill system, closing St. John's, creating a new landfill out in eastern Oregon, and finding a way to transport or consolidate, transfer, and transport waste 150 miles away for disposal. And I think we're now at that point in time where it's we need to be thinking about how we build out the system, how we improve the system, how we create more opportunities with the system. I'll put this in as a reminder very quickly. These are the values expressed in the plan, from protecting the environment and human health to conserving natural resources and so on. You hear these almost every time I speak or one of our staff members speaks, so I won't go through them again. I do think it's useful to go through the regional waste plan goals, including sort of goals 1 through 4, which have to do with shared prosperity and garbage and recycling systems through better engagement, local benefits, living wage, and workforce diversity. The need to invest in communities so that those communities regard solid waste facilities as assets and not liabilities. improving the system for recovery, especially of food and other recyclables and yard debris, and meeting challenging and changing markets and evolving community needs. We're also looking to maintain a system of facilities to ensure better geographic distribution of services and more equitable access to those services. We're also looking to ensure routine garbage and recycling systems can be restored quickly following disruption, whether it be a winter event in the gorge or an earthquake that would be more potentially devastating. I had one handout that I left with you with the idea that we're really moving from the basic solid waste services, which include things like self-haul, recycling depot, household hazardous waste drop-off, commercial transfer. Those are sort of the base functions that we have performed for the last 25 or 30 years, and we're looking to expand the suite of public services to include things like education and learning within facilities, resale and repair stores at facilities, community meeting space, and creating assets for communities, potential public park and trail opportunities, and, of course, disaster debris staging and resilience. So we have some way in a disaster that we have a way to accumulate the debris and then process it in a timely and FEMA fundable way. Other improvements, of course, we're looking at, some of which I mentioned, but greenhouse gas reduction, creating more flexible space, because I don't think any of us working in solid waste 30 years ago could have anticipated the system that we have today. Likewise, I think we need to create a more flexible system that will serve us well into the future. We also need to be more aware of jobs in the economy and the impacts on local neighborhoods and the local economy. We also need to be thinking about fueling, whether it's renewable natural gas, whether it's potential electrification of the fleet. These are all, we're on the horizon. Obviously, RNG is already in place, but the electrification of the fleet, especially garbage trucks in particular, is a likely possibility, and also keeping the rail option on the table as we think about moving large volumes of waste to eastern Oregon or eastern Washington. The regional priorities, and I'm going to just tick through the first three of these, really, and this is sort of the priority that we've set in PES and that council has helped us establish, but first and foremost is food waste collection and processing and finding a way to do that. Second is modernizing existing infrastructure, existing facilities. And third is improving the geographic distribution of services, especially on the west side. The others are important, but those top three are the ones that we are really focused on within PES right now. We also, as I mentioned, expanding public services, creating more equitable access to services is an important thing, improving the recovery infrastructure. That's not really part of this, but that's going to be another issue that will be coming to you to discuss later this year or early next year. And pursue where we can opportunities for public-private partnerships. And so I'm going to turn it over to Brian and Cinnamon here to really talk about the financing tools we have available to us as we think about building out the system and making these changes. So,
thank you, Roy. So my purpose today is to give a short overview of the types of financing tools we would use if the council decides to move forward on these potential investments. Basically, we have two tools, pay-as-you-go financing or debt financing. As you recall, the solid waste utility is an enterprise utility, so we use a different set of tools than we do for things like affordable housing, parks and nature, or improvements at the Oregon Zoo. One other key difference is that because these financing tools use are based on solid waste fees, they don't require voter approval, unlike measures that we have to refer to the ballot for housing, parks, transportation. It's also important to note that Metro's financial management practices over the last 30 years have set the stage for us to have flexibility in how we finance these potential improvements to the system. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And also, it's we should note that we've used these tools before over the last 30 years in how we finance the system, the public portion of the system as we know it today. So first, looking at pay-as-you-go financing, it's a, really just describing financing capital projects from current revenue. That's how we fund renewal and replacement today. And again, this is based on fees we collect for solid waste services, the Metro tip fee at Metro transfer stations, as well as the Metro regional system fee. We also can use our solid waste reserves, our fund balance, that we've built up over the last 30 years. That fund balance, which we've generated because of conservative fiscal management, does give us a lot of flexibility to start making investments without having to use borrowing right off the bat. Second tool is debt financing. Again, financing capital projects through the issuance of revenue bonds. These are different than general obligation bonds that we issue for affordable housing or parks and nature investments. These revenue bonds are backed by solid waste fees. Like any other bond, they can only be used for capital expenditures. And they're a very common tool in financing utility operations. We used them before, as Roy mentioned, when the system transitioned away from the St. John's landfill in building Metro Central. That's the last time we've issued bonds for Metro solid waste facilities. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Cinnamon to talk about the rate setting process and next steps that we would recommend.
Good afternoon, Council. So I think some of you guys have had a good understanding over the last few years of sort of our rate setting process, and I know some of you in the last few months have just been introduced to it. So we thought just a general overview of sort of how we put together the rates would be a really a good way to sort of go into this. So I think what our first step is really cost recovery, which is where we go and look at our annual financial obligations, and so we budget it. So that's sort of our budget process, and we put those numbers together. And this includes our, how to fund our operations for the next fiscal year, our capital investments, and our renewal and replacements. And then one of the last parts is like the fiscal compliance part of that, and that's like having them, making sure we have 45 days of operating reserves, things of that nature. So we consider that when we do our fiscal, we're looking at our annual financial obligations. If we had debt in that period, we would include the debt payments in that process. At sort of the same time, we're also taking a look at our criteria, our rate setting criteria, and making sure that we are just, that we're being consistent in our approach. So that's sort of like how we start that. And then when we do the rates, then we take that information, those budget numbers, and we put it in our rate model along with the forecasted tonnage that Joel Sherman and the information analysis team put together. And that tool creates our rates. And at that point, they're preliminary. And we really take a, we look at them and we have a discussion. And one of the things is like Tom Chamock and I really take a look, and then we bring in Matt Carratt, and then we bring in Roy Brower, or now it'd be Warren Johnson. And we would actually sort of have those conversations about what that means and some programmatic decisions. And for example, keeping the commercial organic rates sort of flat because those are programmatic needs. And then at that point, we present them to you for adoption, and we communicate them with our local jurisdiction. So that's sort of our rate process, and then you guys get to take a look at it, ask questions, and adopt as you would see them. So every year you get to see them. So that's sort of that part of the process. So there are some utility financing best practices for capital infrastructure, and so one of those things is the combination of pay-as-you-go and debt financing. And the GFOA, the Governmental Financing Officers Association, sort of has an 80-20 rule. And that means 80% should be debt and 20% should be current revenue, so which we would create out of our rates. And part of the concept behind that is making sure that everybody who uses the system sort of pays for the system over a long generation of people. So in addition to that, we would always sort of recommend at least a 20-year bond, right? So we're paying, so at least 20 years people are invested in that system and they're paying for it. And then we would still consider renewal replacement sort of something that we pay with current revenues or a fund balance reserve, because we should be planning for those along the way, and that's something that we can plan. So with that, we would take a look, and so looking at that combination of our best practices, the next best practice is to update our long-term capital program, and our long-term capital program should include that the new capital investment that we would have, and also sort of looking at renewal and replacement over a long period of time, like 10 to 15 years. And when we think about that, I think the important things to think about, we always want to include our due diligence, and sometimes due diligence creates that we need to put some money up front, so we make sure we make the right decisions. And then also it includes both money and time for community engagement and making sure that we're making the right investment in the right area. And then the other part of that is also scope creep. That includes both time and money and contingency. And then we would also want to make sure that we have expected service in service dates, so we can also do our operational planning so we can take advantage of that timing. So those are sort of that long-term capital investment. And then part of that would be, part of that is just sort of looking at the whole picture. And that helps us define and build our detailed financing strategy. And so it sort of all builds up to that. And when you put what is important in that detailed financing strategy, I should say, is that what will be paid for by the debt, which is obviously new capital, which is what the bond sort of requires, what's going to be paid for by the rate, both current revenue, the current revenue, so it would be for renewal and replacement, also any the 20% that we would talk about, et cetera, time and time value of money, which we need to think about how long it takes, things are going to be more expensive 8 years from now, 15 years from now, and interest. And then when to sell the bonds or how to sell the bonds. Do we do them in 100 million tranches, things like that? So we don't want to spend money and pay for that, or we don't want to buy money and then pay that interest before we need to, and things like that. And then the last thing that I really think is important is that we also create a performance management criteria and a feedback loop, and then it's constantly being updated. And so that's sort of like how we would really truly sort of look at that whole package and how we would want to finance it and make sure that we have a good system.
So I'll stop here and see if you have any questions or anything you want us to address.
So I've got a quick one, because I wasn't here for the last conversation. When you went over the whole thing, and it appears to me that while you are 100% on the right track as process, I think the thing that's missing for me is the scenarios to come back based on prioritization and understanding of how much the council is willing, how far we're willing to go, and how far the user tipping fee type of conversation will take us to get towards that. And so I'm not sure if I'm misunderstanding that there's a 100% we're going to build out the plan. This is the time to figure out how to build out the plan between now and the 20 years. Or if there are some, I'm assuming, some major prioritization issues that we need to resolve, and I would rather have that come back as a scenario conversation based on how much can we do and what will it cost, and how, and not as, I'm not sure if we're ready to talk about which kind of financing goes to which yet if we don't know what we're doing. So enlighten me.
Yes. And for those of you who are at the executive session, I think we went into some of that.
I'm not talking about the executive session. Okay. I'm talking about what we can actually, how do you marry these two concepts together?
Right.
So coming back with a conversation about how we prioritize things within the actual financial plan. Because the plan is a plan. Not all of it can be done.
Sure.
Some priorities have been given. But how does that play out in terms of the finances, and what goes first and how it goes first? I think that's where I'm much more interested. I think it's a good overview, but I think the next step is really up to a policy discussion of how do those priorities get played out through the financing plan itself.
Right. President Peterson, I would say that, yes, we have a plan that we're working on. We're using the regional waste plan as the launching point. We want to come back to you with a more complete, and we've been talking about this, a more complete synchronization, if you will, of the priorities with the financing, with the actual projects and properties that we have in mind. And we can start to share that, I think, especially the first part of that where we're talking about specifically the food waste component. And I think that would be one of the next things we'd want to come back and talk as goal number one or priority number one, how we see that going forward.
I may follow up with you because I don't want to take up any more of our time, but I don't see the scenarios playing out that way. I think the scenarios are much more policy-oriented about how do things proceed as priorities and where does that take us next. I know we have best practice asset management work going on right now, and how does that play out with a food compost, and which goes first, how they move along is kind of a policy issue of whether we want to actually get rid of the lines at our transfer stations because the compactors are always shut down, versus how we move forward with a new way to be able to get the food. I think that we need to have that conversation of how does it play out if you prioritize this first, this second, this third? What if you flip it? How does that deal with the rates then? When do the rates have big jumps? I think that's the next step in the conversation. So I'm willing to sit down and talk to you a little bit more about that, but figuring out what our best practices for management of our own system are, along with the policies, the new policies, sure. I think those are prioritization discussions that we need to have. So.
Perfect.
And I'm not saying, well, I'll disagree with your recommendation. Right. I'm just saying that that type of conversation is the exact type of conversation that council should be having. Councillor Lewis, Councillor Stacey.
Yeah, thank you. When I think through kind of the president's request for scenario system, a system scenario map would be really helpful, yes, but I can also think to my Metro South, yes, it's mine. I can think of six or seven different problems we're solving for, and all of them involve additional investment. So when faced with the question of how are we going to finance this additional investment just in this one place, not given that there's going to be competing interests and who goes first, I'm really curious about the general best practice of 80-20 debt, liquid cash. Is that a max that's the best standard, or is that the actual mix that's the best standard? And for some reason, having all that capital at once is better than a 70-30 or a 60-40.
Councilor Lewis, I think I'd say just like with any best practice, there's not necessarily any magic in that number. I think it's really the principle behind the number, which is that there needs to be intergenerational equity in financing of long-term capital assets. So making sure that some of this fund balance that's been built up by fees paid by current users of the system as well as future users, everybody contributes to the system, and that as we actually get into it, we look at and figure out what is best for Metro and the region and the users of the system.
Thank you. You teed up almost exactly what I was hoping you would say, particularly as a lot of us 20s and 30s are inheriting a lot of debt that's come our way through choices that haven't been the best choices. I definitely want to make sure that we're not doing the same to our solid waste system, which we have been really forward-thinking up until this time. The other thing I want to think of, though, is not only the values of how we're buying our money, but how we're buying a workforce. And when you buy debt, you're actually enabling yourself to have a bigger, more robust workforce system in the present, but fewer of the long-term jobs that you would see with our more liquid money. So I want to make sure that we're really thinking through what are our workforce values if we are going to bond, because we would have the opportunity for some really robust workforce conversations, I think, if we do go the bonding route.
Councillor Stacey.
For my part, I find nothing controversial, surprising, or worrisome about what you presented today. I think it's basic municipal finance. Didn't need this briefing. And I'm prepared to have a robust discussion about how much we can do as soon as possible. I'm less concerned about the priority ranking of projects. I saw a bundle of investments that I think are direct outputs the last 6 years of planning, and I'm ready to start. So thanks for bringing this forward.
Councilor Craddock?
Regarding your the questions you have and then their next steps, you know, is there general agreement that the financing approach is reasonable? Yeah, of course. Yes, it is. We've used that, and it's very sound. And you have a lot of history of showing that this is a really reasonable and sound way to fund things for the future. I think what the missing piece is regarding what Metro Council President was saying is your next step is tour facilities, secure properties. But what's not in there is, what are we doing? We have a financing mechanism, but what are we building? And that is not what's clear here.
We have had discussions about that. We need to refine.
Yes, I know the general. Yes, and I know the generalities. I know that some of the things that we're looking, considering. But I think that's what you're pointing out. Am I correct? Is that we? This is definitely a sound way to finance, and we're going to start looking at facilities. Maybe we need to review again. In some fashion, what we're building or what we're going to be financing. So, and I don't see that here.
Okay. Councilor Dirksen.
Thank you. I would agree with everything I've heard so far. In general, based on your presentation and your questions of us, yes, I believe that the combination of pay-as-you-go and debt financing is the way to go. Because of standard practices, 80-20 is typically about right, but I don't know that we need to tie ourselves to that. But so this is very general. This is a general process going forward, and I would agree with it, but there's a lot of detail. You say, is there other information needed? Yes, a lot. I would suggest that under next steps, between tour facilities in Seattle and secure properties, we need to have a very complex or complete overview of exactly what we're going to do, what the construction programs are, how that changes our practices of our operations going forward, and a prioritization of. And I obviously want to know what your priority is, what you think we need to build first. How does that impact the whole system? How do we integrate it into the way we're doing things? And then we take the next step, build the next thing. I think I need to see all of that before I would say, yeah, let's go buy a piece of property. Because I don't know, until I see that, I don't know that any particular piece of property is the right piece of property or anything else. So I would need to see a lot more of what the actual plan for design and construction and what impact that has on operations, what all that is playing out before I feel like we as a agency are ready to start buying land and doing whatnot. Because you need that other step in between for us to see everything that's going on.
And I appreciate that view. I think another important aspect of this, which we're factoring in, is how we engage the community as we design and determine what the services are that are going to be provided, especially in a new area. It may be one thing if you have an existing facility and you're redesigning maybe a different set of criteria and engagement than if you're building it in a, you know, on a green field or near a neighborhood. So.
All right, Councilor Chase, and then Mr. Scott.
Well, I would just fifth, I guess, the comments that have already been said in terms of just kind of that component of the projects and what we, you know, we had the executive session. It was very good. We didn't make decisions there. I guess my one question, and then I think the 80-20, however that lands, there's also a relationship between what kind of rates are needed to support that, whether it can support 80% or not. And how much do we have? So here's a direct question. How much is our fund balance now?
$56 million.
Okay.
But we should note some of those reserves are restricted
right, for
some purposes.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
So I think that's the type of scenario. How do you buy down the what goes first out of those 56 before you start raising rates, or do you start raising rates now and start building out some of these things that need to be built out? There are different ways to move forward.
Yeah.
And it's within our financial oversight capability to make sure that the policies are matching out the financial action plan. So I don't...
That's, yeah, if I could summarize, because I really appreciate all the feedback, and I think it makes total sense. And what I'm hearing from council pretty unanimously is, you know, as we talk about these next steps, coming back with that 20-year plan, more specifically in terms of what the staging are. And staging is in the sequence, but then also what the options are,
mm-hmm.
right? We could do some things first and something second, or switch them, and then really walk through what those variables are. You know, how quickly do we need to address the issues? We can address them within 5 years. We can address them within 20 years. You know, how much debt versus cash? And this is a conversation that absolutely best practice allows you to sort of, you know, have that conversation, you know, as a council, and then how high the rates are and sort of how much we're willing to do. Because all of those variables are impacted by that decision. So, we need to come back as staff with more of those options and scenarios to have a more detailed this conversation. And I think hopefully this sets that up for that future conversation.
Definitely.
Okay.
And then I guess my big question is, because this council is so, I mean, just since I've been on it 6 months, is what I've absorbed from those who have been working on this much longer, really want the recycling public-private partnership not to be a footnote or an asterisk, but like, how is it the parallel program? So how do we put that into the scenario discussion as well, so that we're meeting the totality of the goals? We have that in our head, and if there's any impact on fees as well.
No, I think that's an important consideration. I put this list of council future topics in here because this was part three, but there's like part four, five, six, seven, and eight coming. That includes things in particular about talking about community engagement in specific locations, investment in partnerships and regional recycling. We're waiting for the state process to play itself out a little bit so we have a better idea of the direction that process is going to set for us. But it's more than a footnote. It's more of a, I guess we're deferring that discussion until we let this process play out through the end of the year. And then we hope to come back, and that will be integrated in with this discussion about investments and so on. We're going to want to talk about the I&I grants, the investment and innovation grants. We're in the middle of a three-year pilot, and at the end of year two, beginning of year three, we probably ought to have that discussion about the continuation of that. Community enhancement fees and programs and how that should work going into the future. And then this gets to the point I think we've been talking about, is developing a long-range master plan for the regional waste system. All the master plans that have been done in the past have been very metro facility specific. It's never envisioned looking at the whole regional system, public and private. And we need to get that piece of the puzzle in place so we can have the broader, longer-term discussion.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to take a stab here. The community engagement, there's a difference between the project level and the financial plan, so I'd want to make sure that we are distinguishing between those, and if we do some scenario discussions, that we're actually looking for and engaging our partners on the whole range of interests along this, about what goes first, how it goes first, so that we've got that kind of input as not just to the project location issue. To me, we have to have an agreement on how we're moving forward because we want to make sure that it's actually meeting the needs of the totality when we, at least 80%, right? There's no perfect plan, but at least 80% of what we're trying to achieve. And then I would just say the waiting till the end of the year on the public-private partnerships, I think there's some policy questions that need to be discussed so that you could move next year to put together a program. right? I don't know why we wait till next year to start talking about the policies inherent to that discussion. So I'm thinking that we should accelerate that.
Okay.
Sorry.
Part of it is, I mean, I think one of the next steps is we want to get some of you up to visit some of these facilities in the Seattle area so you can just see the possibilities both for modern transfer stations and recovery opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once you get a view of that, then it'll give you a little more perspective about what we can do down here. I put out an email this morning about a pilot secondary MRFing project that we're helping to fund that will give us more information about what's left in the residual from the MRFs,
mm-hmm.
And plus a little bit of ocean plastic sorting to figure out what's in the stuff that's washing up on the beaches, and is there some way that we can move researchers and manufacturers to developing better plastic products that have less of an impact on ocean and ocean beaches. So we're working on some of those things that feed into. We have other projects going on. I'm happy to come back and talk more extensively about that, probably with Matt Corot at my side. But yes, we are gearing up for a bigger discussion on recycling in the future.
Okay. Well, if we could accelerate that would be great, rather than waiting for the perfect day to get us all up there. I'm kind of worried about that, but we'll do our best. But I think moving forward, at least with an understanding of what the policy questions that need to be addressed, would be a good start to getting everybody thinking, even before the tour.
Great.
Thank you for the presentation and the background and the willingness to move forward on more scenarios.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Mr. Scott.
The only thing I have, just actually scheduling issues, just to remind everyone that council meeting is canceled for this Thursday, and next Tuesday's work session we will be up at the zoo, and I think we've got a fun agenda planned for that. We'll be at the zoo next Tuesday. No meeting this Thursday. Those are my only updates.
Thank you.
All right. Any councilor communications before we call up Ernest Hayes? Yeah, Councilor Credit.
Two things. Yesterday was the East Multnomah County Transportation Committee meeting. This is that monthly meeting that occurs prior to JPAC. But the interesting part of the meeting, I thought, was the discussion around a presentation by ODOT regarding the Columbia Gorge Express. This is a bus system that's been created by ODOT. It's a feasibility study looking at how to relieve congestion at Multnomah Falls. And as you know, if you've tried to go, if you've gone up the gorge, that right now the parking lot at Multnomah Falls is full 90% of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And to be able to allow people to visit the falls, they've started this bus system where they shuttle people from Rooster Rock State Park to Multnomah Falls. But in addition,
can't you even catch the bus at Gateway?
Yes. In addition, the bus does start from Gateway. There's 7 buses a day that leave Gateway.
It's Hood River Transit that provides that, which is separate from what ODOT's doing. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, right now it's Columbia Gorge. It's the Columbia Gorge Express connects people at the Gateway Transit Center, takes them to the Multnomah Falls, and also stops along the way at Rooster Rock. In addition to that, though, now their bus does travel all the way to both Cascade Locks and to Hood River. I think there's 3 or 4 buses a day that go to those two facilities. They have 5 total buses, and so the challenge is to still, if they're even overwhelmed with that, is that once ODOT turns on, when the parking lot is full at Multnomah Falls, they turn on the sign, and within minutes, there's hundreds of cars pulling into Rooster Rock State Park to park there so they can take the shuttle. So, and the challenge you're running into now is There are multiple events planned at Rooster Rock State Park for the future that will fill up that parking lot already
on its own.
And then, so it's fascinating. It's just, it's a huge challenge. And like Lynn was saying, is that there are plans that this is going to be transferred over to the, it's called the Hood River, or it's, I forget the name of Columbia something or other transit. So there's a transit operator in Hood River that is now has transit between Hood River and Mount Hood and up that direction, Highway 35. So they haven't solved anything yet. It's just more just to make you aware of some of the challenges that they're running into. The long-term funding still has to be decided what we're going to do or what they're going to do. ODOT has about 2 more years on this, on their grant that they have, and figure out how they're going to resolve this. But it's really a significant challenge. Meanwhile, Multnomah County and ODOT are working on what they're going to do about the historic Columbia River Highway and how to manage traffic along that. There is some discussion that maybe make the highway one lane for traffic and the other lane will be for bike ped. That's one option, but they haven't come to a decision on that. So I just think it's just fascinating how big a challenge this is. 73% of the... I wrote down some statistics here. 60% of the riders on the bus are from out of state. 12% are international from places outside the U.S., and they have 5 total buses and 7 daily trips from Gateway to Multnomah Falls. So it's just fascinating to see the challenges they have trying to, what they're going to do about this for the future. Is a pretty big challenge. So the second item I wanted to report on is Councilor Chase and I, last Tuesday when we missed the Metro Council work session, we attended the opening of the Blackburn Center. And this is a facility built by Central City Concern on 122nd and Burnside. Mr. Blackburn is the former executive director of Central City Concern and was the brainchild of this facility. It's really a remarkable. It's 9 stories. And if you drive 122nd, all of a sudden this building is just huge above all the other buildings around, and it's black. I don't know if that was intentional to be named after Blackburn. But it's a full medical facility there. There's a lab. There are all the necessary medical needs for people. This is for homeless people. There are rooms for people that are leaving recovery and transitional beds. There are beds there for people that are at the end of their life, palliative care. There are shared rooms where people can share rooms, and they have community kitchens. And then there are even some market rate rooms. And what else am I overlooking?
Quite a few buildings that are located very close and closely connected to the facility, too. So there's a lot more housing that you don't see that's also connected to the facility.
Yeah, so it's really well planned, and we were there probably longer than you were in your meeting. It went all afternoon, and the reason what contributed to that is the number of people that have organizations and agencies have contributed to the construction of this building. This is the first time that all major health system in the region contributed money up to about $25 million total. Adventist, Sisters of Providence, Legacy, Kaiser Permanente, they all contributed significant amounts of money because of the value of this facility to care for homeless people that they traditionally see in their emergency rooms. So it was really interesting. I don't know if you wanted, if anyone wanted to add.
That was fantastic.
It's really quite remarkable.
And Councilor Craddock did a very good job of representing the council and speaking at the event.
Well, there were a lot of speakers.
More than I've ever seen, I think.
Whew, yes, they're all.
Well, no wonder it took all afternoon.
Yeah.
Anybody else with a quick update? Thanks.
We had our 185th lit tour yesterday.
Was it?
It was lit. It was just lit. It was one of the funnest meetings I've ever been to. Let's just say
that. I only went on the bus tour, and that was fun, too.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Thank you to Andy. Thank you to Victor. Thank you to everyone that coordinated it. And I'm so excited to go on more tours and for them to get lit. The committee had a really good discussion. Naturally, the things that rose to the top were safety, pedestrian safety, options, reliability. It's interesting because the nature of transit just takes on a different kind of essence when you're in the burbs, obviously. And the barriers that people have, although they're similar, somewhat different.
Yes.
So I thought it was very fruitful.
And all I would add is I was struck and favorably impressed by how the membership of this committee really reflects the populations of Washington County. And it was also inspiring to go from the north end of Councilor Gonzalez's district to the north end of Councilor Dirksen's as we crossed TV Highway to do our little turnaround.
They switched sides. Funny.
It's a very important regional artery and deserves a lot of attention.
Good. Got it, Rose's help. Anybody else?
The tours continue. Tonight is the tour of the Clackamas County portion of the C2C, which I will be on.
Great. Take good notes and tell us what you saw.
I might live stream it.
Anything else? Councilors Stacy and Councilor Chase and I presented to Multnomah County today on the regional investment strategies. We have one scheduled for Washington County as well as Clackamas County, two different formats. But we've got them scheduled, and we're looking at trying to get into the city of Portland. I know we've made the request, and you guys are thinking about how to also have those conversations with the cities within your districts and continue to have that regional investment strategies conversation out in front and playing over and over and over again on cable would be great. Thanks. I thought that the Multnomah County Commission was excited to have us there, actually.
Yeah. They were super enthusiastic.
We should have brought flowers.
Were there questions?
There were questions.
In the form of tell me more.
I think basically kind of tell me more. And
Albina Vision came up.
Albina Vision was definitely of interest for the commission. I would say I would add when talking about housing out in our other presentations, really emphasizing that we are really relying and how important and wonderful it is to have local implementation strategies and communities where they can decide how and where to put these units and how to move them forward because they have the expertise in their communities. Mm-hmm. I think that was an important point that would go over well in other jurisdictions as well.
And we also talked about breaking down the silos, that the funding mechanisms are starting to overlap in terms of how they're trying to point to each other and all our goals, not just transportation, housing, parks. They're starting to overlap so we can get more bang for a buck. So you reacted well to that. So thank you for everybody who's going to participate on those. I'm sure we'll be doing it again this fall. So get ready for that. Anything else? Will we go to the order? Then I'll ask Ernest to come up. Thanks. So you've got a letter before you.
Good afternoon, Council President and Councilors. I am back again with a new letter. Ernest Hayes, Policy Advisor, for the record.
We can't hear you, Ernest. Sorry.
Mike is very directional.
What we have before you today is a proposed response to our Housing Oversight Committee. They sent you a letter that was forwarded by Emily Lieb, dated June 25th, which is also included in front of you, making some requests about the way in which some of the implementation will be structured for the housing measure. Namely, in the center there, they kind of bold out their recommendation, and it relates to a 20% aspirational goal for utilization of MWESB contractors and for workforce diversity. Staff has been working with our two liaisons, Councillor Chase and Lewis, to brief you both on both the presence of this letter and then also sort of a possible response. Following those conversations, which occurred over the last few weeks, we have put together this proposed response for you, which I sent out last Tuesday for your review and any comment or question. And today we're here just to see if there are any lingering questions that we can help answer and see if we can get a signal that this is the response that you'd like to provide to the Oversight Committee, which would be sent to them upon approval, and then it will be ready for them on their next meeting, which is Wednesday the 24th, next Wednesday.
Essentially, how many do we have left on the IGAs that are not at 20% yet? Do we know? Okay. Do we know? The number of jurisdictions that haven't yet agreed to
20%. Well, no jurisdictions have formally. We just received two jurisdictions.
Why don't you come on up? Thanks.
Are we talking about C2P2? Are you talking about?
No, this is the outside of C2P2 is on a path towards regional implementation, but this is coming before that. So we have been trying to get a voluntary agreement by all of the jurisdictions that are working on the affordable housing implementation to get to a 20% utilization. What am I trying to say?
Seven of them.
Yeah. In the word eight.
Yes.
Eight to eight?
Because Metro is also an implementing jurisdiction.
So, President Peterson, to answer your question, I am not certain. We have so far received two local implementation strategies from the City of Beaverton and Washington County, and staff are working to reduce those plans, which are I think one is over 100 pages, to a summary, and share that more broadly with you and the Oversight Committee, and there we will have specifically that answer for you. So very shortly, I believe one of the jurisdictions is setting an aspiration goal of 20%, and another of the jurisdictions is not, but that is off my recollection, so I'm not certain. So I can't fully answer your question at this time, but some of the jurisdictions haven't stated that specifically. We do know that the City of Portland is on track to increase its existing goal at 20% to 30%, and that Home Forward already maintains an agency-wide commitment of 20%, whereas all of the other jurisdictions are answering this question programmatically for the first time in their local implementation strategies.
So we would be supporting the committee in their request to getting to 20%, but we're telling them that we're still underway with the discussions, and we will do everything we can to get them towards that 20%.
Right, and the letter reflects that there's an acknowledgement that some jurisdictions are already meeting the 20% goal or exceeding it, and there's an anticipation that they would continue to increase that success, and that some may need a more time to fulfill a 20% requirement, so that we would seek year after year to see continued improvement towards that 20% goal until we reach the 20% as requested by the Oversight Committee.
Yeah. Councillor Lewis.
I think it's a great letter, and I think it's the right approach, and I do hope that our bond oversight committee is open to the response, and I think that they've had individual conversations with some of us going back months on this, uh-huh. So I'm really glad that we have this to codify where we are on the policy side. With that being said, just one minor line edit. Next to last paragraph, last line, it says further advance. I believe it should be further advance scene, ING.
Say that again.
It should be further advancing, like ING.
There's a grammar term for that form that I don't remember.
Yeah.
So I thank you. I did help kind of chime in on this letter, and you know, the one nuanced area is that the Housing Oversight is asking for a 20% aspirational goal in each of the jurisdictions, and we're saying, well, we want to encourage that, but we'll be okay with an average for the region, which, I mean, some jurisdictions may carry others. I think with COVID, to me, it's pretty broad brush strokes in some ways with COVID. And so I'm only pointing that out to say that that's sort of a a little bit of a compromise kind of a position. I think that we could strengthen our response by really beefing up the workforce diversity component, and I think that we do talk about that there, and we talk about acknowledging it. I didn't want to kind of push for this to be in the language, but other than to bring it up here in council, where I would like to, you to consider adding something that strengthens the workforce diversity commitment. We have, of course, the budget note that we passed in June that is already getting us on track to help provide some technical assistance to jurisdictions, so we're working toward that. We are also working with C2P2, which is looking, I think, to get some technical assistance out to the community. And so if there was a way to signal support for technical assistance for jurisdictions to develop workforce diversity goals in housing bond implementation, and I think that might be a nice addition.
That would be sort of an add to that addition. Last full paragraph on page one, where we're talking about the C2P2.
I hadn't thought about where specifically it might fit in, but I think it would just be...
We talk about encouraging, you're talking about providing technical assistance as well as encouragement.
We encourage all participating jurisdictions. Yeah, so the second to last paragraph you said on the first page, yes. I think you would add in there, we encourage all participating jurisdictions in the housing bond to participate in the project, and then add something like, we also will look for opportunities to support technical assistance for jurisdictions to develop workforce, something like that.
So our, in the bond, we restricted ourselves to 5% administrative costs, and it's pretty lean. And I guess how, you know, I'm thinking about that, adding that, what that it means that we're picking up, we're going to help. Does that mean we're going to give money to the cities, or we're going to actually do some of the work for them? I guess how do we financially afford that and stay within that 5%?
Well, I think that's within the kind of confines of this budget note also to develop a plan so that we will consider that. So I can't answer how much or what would be needed specifically. I know that we're working as an agency toward that. What I would say is that this wouldn't necessarily be a housing, these wouldn't be, in my mind, the housing dollars. These would be additional technical support contributions that we would identify at, you know, per the budget note, we would, that's what we would be identifying and looking at in the fall. Where are those
I'm
resources?
Just curious, I don't know how much work this is, so
Councilor Dirksen.
I have the same concern. I'm not opposed to the idea of providing jurisdictions who just, they're not at a place where they can do this yet, from finding ways to help them. I'm concerned if we put it in the letter, it kind of commits us to that. Before I was willing to commit, I'd want to have, I think we feel like we need to have more discussion about what that really commits us to. Not putting it in the letter doesn't preclude us from being able to do it. I'm a little nervous about it at this point putting it in the letter.
I think we've already talked to them about committing time and energy from Metro to help them to get to a higher goal. I think we've already started down that path, if I am correct.
Yes, all around, actually. So there are the capacity, the technical assistance and capacity needed to implement COVID or MWESB goals and programs is more attainable, if you will, than full the work kind of suite of workforce programming. And that is why you see in this letter and in much of the conversation we've had sort of trying to maintain our full commitment to advancing workforce goals and waiting for the C2P2 programming to come into fruition and start building out that capacity, because there's a lot to be learned and a lot of support that will come from that work. So I would say yes, the capacity technically, it's mostly technical capacity to support COVID goals, absolutely, and then the commitment to support the workforce goal and programming is a little more TBD And that's we're in a timing challenge right now where these local implementation strategies are coming forward. The Oversight Committee wants to act, and C2P2 is still in flux and moving. And what the opportunity here for us is to move these local implementation strategies forward, knowing that every year they come back for review from the Oversight Committee, and there will be opportunities to check back and signal next steps and forward motion. And the workforce programming is where we expect to see forward motion in 1 year, because we will have the C2P2 program to lean on.
So I think what I think is going to trip up our Oversight Committee is reasonable time frame. Those words are pretty generic, with no expectation that they will, if they don't meet it in their initial year, that they will meet it soon afterwards. And soon afterwards doesn't mean at the end. So this reasonable time frame, I'm not willing to wordsmith the document, but I am willing to tell you what our intent would be, and reasonable is not the end. And I think we all can agree we're not trying to meet a goal at the end of this project. We're trying to meet it as soon as possible. So the stronger that we can be on getting it, if it's not the first year, then it's the second year. It's not the right. We need to keep pushing. And I know that stresses out the conversations, but it's a good stress that we need to keep working on. And if we're putting money and resources into helping them meet it for the second year, I'm just not willing to say reasonable time frame is the third to fifth, seventh year.
At the same time, reasonable time frame is the language the Oversight Committee used in their recommendation to us. So I think that there's some components of the letter are a direct reflection of the language in a response to them. But
I just want to make sure we are all in agreement that reasonable time frame is not.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, to articulate a plan, it doesn't mean even having a plan or implementing a plan. They just need to be able to articulate a plan. I think within 2 years is a reasonable time frame.
So you want more specific?
I don't think we need to. We just need to make sure that they understand that's what we mean.
I think as we are negotiating and the staff understand where we're headed, I think that we can work it out.
So, but are we in agreement then with Councillor Chase's suggestion?
I don't agree.
I think I'm not hearing necessarily agreement. I will just say, my only intention really is to just articulate and signal that we are moving forward in a couple of areas that are, I think, as impactful as, if not more impactful than some of this COVID work. So it was really an intention to not push us in a direction, but to articulate the direction that we're heading in. And so that was really more my intention.
So if there's a sentence that says, and we are also moving on these other things, is
related
what you
to
were
workforce.
Asking.
I wouldn't even say C2P2. I would just keep it general around workforce development.
Okay.
I just have a question. How you measure this? I'm my experience sitting on the Oregon Zoo Citizens Oversight Committee on how they measure this is sometimes kind of. Traditionally, you have some of those COVID firms working early on in a project, and because they're part, that's part of the project. It's not real specific. It's more generality stuff. And then they phase out, and I'm just curious, is there some way we measure this at all, and how we, is there a system that's already in place
yes.
on how you measure it?
Yeah.
I would say there are systems in place, and there's also work underway to get more of a regional consistency in how we are tracking. Right now, the existing the jurisdictions that have existing COVID goals are using generally a measurement of the number of dollars that are of the construction dollars that go to COBIG certified subcontracting firms, and they rely on the general contractor to report out, usually through the lead developer and then to the funding jurisdiction. So that is the system in place right now that we'll be utilizing. There is even deeper detail that you can get into in how you measure, and there's There's interest in disaggregating the COBID certified firms, and are they certified based on woman ownership or a person of color who's owning the company. And also there's interest in expanding subcontracting to include the soft costs, like architectural firms. So yes, there's a system, and yes, it's continuing to develop. And then similar can be said about tracking and monitoring of workforce, although that is a much more complex system that needs a lot more technical support and capacity to build out regionally.
So at the timeline that we're on, Councillor Chase, are you okay if we proceed as is and we articulate to the council that we also have these other things going on just verbally?
Yeah, that's okay.
Since we can't get to verbiage right now? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we just make sure that the Oversight Committee knows when it's being presented that this isn't the only thing we're working on as Metro and workforce?
I'm sorry, President Pisa, I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
Rather than trying to include it and get down to the specific verbiage to be included in the letter so we can get this letter out, can we just let them know this is one of the many things we're working on in terms of workforce?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Just one more point of clarification.
Yeah.
Are we in regard to the in a reasonable time frame, is that being requested to be changed to a date specific?
No, I'm asking staff to just make sure it's very clear to everybody that it's not the seventh year you make the goal.
We know that when you wrote that letter to us, you didn't mean by the end of the grant, the end of the process, but as soon as possible.
Yes. Okay.
I think you're good to go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further business before the council? Ms. McLaren, anything? How's it going?
It's going well. This is my first full week.
I'm
feeling
my
next full week.
Okay.
But no, it's my first full week. It's going well. And certainly learning a lot about the diversity of issues at Metro, and appreciate again the willingness of many Metro staff to walk back to the beginning of things as they're describing to me some of the projects, as well as, of course, the attorneys in the Office of Metro Attorney.
Thank you. Great. Awesome.
I will say, actually, if I can, just I went on a tour this morning that's sponsored by the Fair Housing Council of Oregon, and we did that with a number with our legal interns as well. And it is an incredible tour about it's the second time I went. I went in part because I was new here, but also because my personal opinion is when you repeat educational experiences, you also learn something new in that. And it is just, for those of you who have not been on the tour, I'd be happy to talk to you about it offline, but I do think it's a very open and good learning experience and relates a lot to the work that this council is doing in the region.
This is the Oregon's historical
Good. All right, thank you. We are adjourned.